Remember, Haman got hung on the second day of Pesach, and we made that connected to the idea of the Omer, that the Omer is the connection between freedom and responsibility, and Amalek rebels against any infringement on its freedom and its autonomy. So that day, Parakas begins, Ahasuerus gave to Esther the house of Haman. We discussed the halachic issue about how are they allowed to have Amalek's property, and it's based on the principle that those who are killed by the king, those who are killed because they rebel against the king, the property belongs to the king, and therefore Esther got it not from Amalek, but Esther got it through Ahasuerus, because Haman was killed because of treason. And then the Pasuk Beis goes on and tells us that the king took his ring that he had given to Haman, he had taken it from Haman, he had given it to Mordechai, and Esther in turn made Mordechai in charge of all of Haman's property. So far so good, but what's so interesting is, as the Megillah makes very clear, the destruction of Haman in no way averted the danger the Jewish people face. There is still a law or a decree that on the 13th of Adar, around 11 months later, 11 months short, 3 days later, the Jews will be eradicated by the population. And there is a peculiarity of Persian law where the king of Persia was considered to be so infallible that he could not even change his own mind. Anything that he decreed was absolute truth. And because it was absolute truth, that which was sent out by the king could not be revoked. So now we have this very big dilemma, right? So look at Pasuk Gimel. This is Perek Ches, Pasuk Gimel. Vatosef Esther. Esther continued. Vatdaber lifnei hamelech. She spoke before the king. Vatipa lifnei raglav. She fell on her knees in front of him. Vateif. She cried. Vatischanein lo. She supplicated him. Lahavir es ra'as Haman ha'agogi, to remove the evil of Haman the Agagite from Agag. V'yeis machshavto, and his plan, his conspiracy, asher chashav al Yehudim. So she's begging to do something. Pasuk Dalet, v'yoshed ha'melech v'yester yishavir azav. So once again, the king extends his golden scepter. V'atakam Esther, Esther gatzav, v'tam levach, she stands in front of the king, v'atomer. And once again, she begs, if it's good with the king, please revoke or rescind the books or the documents that Haman had sent out, because how can I stand and see the destruction that will befall my people, etc. So, at first, Ahasuerus' response is the following. Ahasuerus says, and again, it's very peculiar to us, why shouldn't he be able to do this? Ahasuerus says, I cannot rescind any decree. If I issued a decree that people have a right to wage war against the Jews and kill them, then that's going to be the law. But I give you the right to authorize the Jews to take countermeasures. In other words, essentially, it's very strange for a king to do. A king is legalizing civil war within his own kingdom. The king is saying, okay, they have a right to kill you, but you have a legal right to kill back. The hope of this was, of course, that the Umos HaOlam, who would otherwise joyously kill the Jews, may not want to do so if the Jews have the legally recognized right to strike back. And that second decree, okay, so this is the second decree. The first decree was that the Jews can be wiped out, the 13th of Adar. The second decree is the Jews have a right of self-defense. And when was this decree issued? So Pasuk Tes tells us, Bachodesh HaShlishi, the third month, counting from Nisan, Iyar, Sivan. Meaning it's interesting that apparently it took Ahasuerus 2 months to come up with this idea, because Haman was hung the 16th of Nisan. But this proposal, this counter-proposal, was not sent out until the 23rd of Sivan, which is more than 2 months later, etc. And it basically gives the Jews that particular right to stand up and defend themselves. What does it say? Asher Nasan, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Asher Nasan HaMelech LaYehudim. The king gave permission to the Jews in every single city, LeHikahel, to assemble, VeLamad Al Nafsham, and to stand up for their lives, LaHashmit ULaHarog, to destroy, to kill, to eradicate, all of the nations that rise against them, including women and children. Now keep in mind, it's very important that in Achashverosh's authorization, it says, Ushlalom Lavos. What does that mean? They are permitted to plunder the spoils. However, the Pasuk makes very clear that when the Jews killed their enemies, they, Bedavka, did not take the spoils, but Achashverosh gave them that particular authorization, etc. And as a result, we are told that the Jews in Shushan were happy. Mordechai is now rejoicing. The city of Shushan is Tzahala V'Samecha. They are singing. And then, of course, if you look at Pasuk Tesayin, we have a famous verse that we recite every Motzei Shabbos in Haftalah. La'Yehudim, for the Jews, Haisa Ora, there was light, V'Simcha, there was joy, the Sasain, also a lashon of joy, vikar, and honor. The Gemara actually explains each of these refers to specific mitzvos that the Jewish people strengthen themselves in as a result of the Purim story. Ora refers to Torah, a recommitment to the learning of Torah, which is light. Simcha refers to bris milah, apparently a rededication to the covenant with God. Yikar, I remember Yikar is tefillin, which I don't remember what the sasan is. These are four different ones. I have it here. Oh, I see. Actually, they have it in the art school on the site. Ora is Torah. Simcha refers to making Purim a holiday. Sasan is circumcision. And Yikar is tefillin. Right? They were able to do these mitzvahs. And it makes the point that there were many, many Jews who even, many, many goyim, who even converted. Right? So essentially, Perek Ches is the promulgation of Achashverosh's second decree that gave the Jewish people a right of self-defense. Perek Tes actually talks about that day coming, and it makes the point that the day that the enemies of the Jews hoped to rule over the Jews, it was reversed, that the Jews ruled over their enemies, they gathered together, and they were able to slay a fantastically amazing number, 75,000 people. Now, you'll notice, though, that it says that in Shushan, they killed a paltry 500, and then it enumerates the 10 children of Haman. See where it says? That's where the column that goes straight down. Parshandasa, Dalfanas, Pasa, Parasa, Dalya, Ridasa, Parmashta, Risa, Aridai, Vaisasa. Now, you may recall from other years that when the Chazan reads the list of the 10 children of Haman, the Chazan is supposed to read them in one breath. He's not supposed to take a breath between the names. So it's a little bit of a tongue twister. Right, Parshandasa, together with the trap. And the reason is because all 10 were strung up on this tree, the same tree that Mordechai, that Haman built for Mordechai, that Haman was hung on. All 10 were strung up on the same tree at the same time, simultaneous. There, somehow they were tied up. It was one beneath the other, but the concept was that the noose was tightened, that one pull, you know, jerked up all 10 bodies, and they were killed b'vas achas. They were killed at one time. And therefore the Chazan says it b'nishima achas, in one breath, to connote the fact that they died b'vas achas. Now there's another interesting thing, and that is, you may recall, that it's also customary in many places, not everywhere, that the congregation also says the 10 children of Haman b'vas achas. In other words, the congregation says it, and then the Chazan says it. Now, why would there be an inyan of the congregation? Now, we know the congregation does recite certain psukim out loud. There are four psukim that the congregation does recite out loud, besides the Aseres B'nei Haman. Let's just point out which four psukim. The first pasuk is in Perek Beis, which introduces Mordechai. That's Perek Beis, pasuk Hei. There was a Jewish man in Shushan whose name was Mordechai. Okay. That's one pasuk. The second pasuk is when Mordechai was honored by the king. That's Perek Ches, pasuk Tesvav. Right, Perek Ches, pasuk Tesvav. Mordechai is honored by the king, so that's read out loud. The next one is the pasuk right after that, by Yehudim Haisa Ayra V'Simcha, the Jews had joy and light. That's pasuk Tesayin, that's the third. And the last pasuk is the last pasuk in the Megillah, which is Perek Yud Pasuk Gimel, that Mordechai the Jew was a great man among his people. And so those are four pasuk, we read those out loud. Now why we read them out loud, that's not so difficult to understand, because they refer to Mordechai saving the Jewish people. In fact, you'll notice all four verses deal with the greatness of Mordechai. However, why do we read the Aseres B'nei Haman out loud? So there's a very interesting analysis that the Rukach of Ragon gives. It's an interesting halachic concept. There's a mitzvah in every Jew to read the Megillah. To read the Megillah. Al Mikra Megillah. So the question we might ask is, how could I be Yotzei when the Chazan reads it, I didn't read it? The answer is, there's a well-known principle in Jewish law called Shomeya. When you hear somebody doing the mitzvah, and he's doing it for you, Ke'ona, it is as if you did it, right? Someone can make Kiddush for me, someone can read the Torah for me, even the repetition of the Shemona Esrei. Well, originally, although now we do it ourselves, but originally, the purpose of the repetition of Shemona Esrei was for people who didn't know how to read, the Chazan would read it for them, right? So, there's a well-known principle called Shomeya. He who hears someone doing it for you, it's as if you did it yourself, right? Shomeya Ka'ona. But here's the thing. Shomeya Ka'ona merely means it's as if I said it. But if there's anything that you have to do in addition to saying it, Shomeya Ka'ona doesn't do that. So here's the problem. Every part of the Megillah, the only halachic requirement is that it be said. So Shomeya Ka'ona is as if I said it. However, for the 10 children of Haman, it's not enough to say the 10 children of Haman. You also have to say it simultaneously. Shomeya Ka'ona, listening, is a valid form of answering. But the surrogate listening, I'm sorry, the surrogate answering via listening is not an answering b'vasachas. But as you see, because if we say you're listening to it silently is halakhically as good as you're saying it, that might be fine, but you certainly can't say it's as if you said it simultaneously. So the Rukach says, whenever there is a principle where in addition to simply saying it, the halakha requires that it be said in a certain manner, Shomeya Ka'ona does not constitute saying it in that certain manner, and that's why you have to say it yourself. And that's why by the Aseres B'nei Haman you have to say it yourself. Yeah, sorry? That's what the Rukach says.
I'm curious, does he bring any other examples of this?
I think he brings by the Beis Levi by Birchas Kohanim. Can a Kohen, who's not able to talk, can one Kohen say the Duchenin for another Kohen? Because of Shomeya Ka'ona. So the Beis Halevi says no, because Birchas Kohanim requires not only that the words be said, but that the words be said out loud. And Shomeya Ka'ona is not an Ona that is out loud. Right? In other words, you can't just say whatever
any qualifications. Yeah.
Right, it can't just be whatever he did, it's like I did it. In other words,
any extra
qualifications, Shomeya Ka'ona doesn't pick up. Now, that's the Chazon Ish asks the Kasha on that, because Chazon Ish says, well, if that's so, then nobody should ever be Yotzei the Megillah if they don't have a kosher Megillah, because the halacha is, you can't just say the words, you got to say the words from a kosher Megillah. In other words, if you're going with that argument, that Shomeya Ka'ona doesn't work when there are other requirements in how you say it, then L'chora Megillah itself has a requirement that you say it from a Megillah. So the Chazon Ish actually differs with the Rukach.
At what point in the halakhic framework with the qualification, I just lost exactly what I was going to say, yeah. Like, well, what point does it become binding as an actual qualification? Like, let's say if Derice says something didn't have any qualification, but later, Shulchan Aruch says, it happens to throw in an illusion, say such and such
right.
with your mouth.
Right. We would simply say this. We would simply say that there's a Torah level of observance, and then there might be a rabbinic level of observance, and on the Torah level of observance, you might be Yotzei by Shomeya Ka'ona, but you couldn't be Yotzei the rabbinic level of observance. We would just divvy it up in terms of Torah observance versus rabbinic observance. But as I say, I mean, I'm not even sure what they do here. In many, many places, they don't have this custom of everybody saying it out loud. The Chazan always says it out loud, but not everybody says it. Yeah. Well, here we have a very interesting distinction between Hebrew and other languages. And that is, technically, I can bench, not the Megillah, but I could bench or even daven in other languages. But the halacha is that I'm not yotzei, benching or davening or shema in any other language, unless I understand what that language says. So the example would be, if there's a chazan in France who is reciting the Amida in French for the benefit of the illiterate Frenchman, and I'm also illiterate, and I have to come in and I don't know French, I do not fulfill my mitzvah by hearing Shimon Esrei in French unless I understand French. If, on the other hand, Lashon HaKodesh, when it comes to Hebrew, Hebrew is considered to be a holy language, therefore one does fulfill the mitzvahs by Shomea Ka'one, or by directly saying it, even if you don't understand where it is. So that's the nafka mina. That is the difference between Lashon HaKodesh and any other language.
Well, again,
I'm saying that it's optimal. Certainly, a mitzvah is much more significant if you know what you're doing, and one is supposed to try to know what they're saying. But there is a concept that Lashon HaKodesh does have a special power to be received by God, even if you're not entirely sure of what you're doing. Although there's a very interesting point that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik remarks. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik says, it's a good insight, he says, even though you could be Yotzei, Shmon Esrei in Hebrew, without even knowing what you're saying, right, that's what we just said, but you have to know that you're davening to God. That's what he says. If you don't have a sense that you're talking to Hashem, then it doesn't count at all. Now, that's very important, because sometimes, well, maybe I'm just talking about myself, I don't want to condemn anybody, but sometimes we can go through a whole davening, and, you know, our mind is wandering, we're not really thinking about it. Even if we know Hebrew, we're not particularly attuned, and there's a real question whether we have fulfilled even the basic. In other words, Chaim says, you don't have to know Hebrew, although it's advisable. You don't have to know Hebrew. You're Yotzei, even if you don't know the words that you said. But you have to know you're conversing with God, and you're praying to God. And if you don't have that conscious awareness, he says, it's not even tefillah at all.
I feel that completely. Right now, I'll go through a whole big thing of Hebrew, because I can read it. If I'll say like one phrase in English, I feel so much more of a communication
with one
at that moment than I did in the whole big block of Hebrew.
Because it was the
language. I'm concentrating so much on just saying the Hebrew.
Well,
that most of my concentration is on that.
Yes, that's a hard question. You are Yotzei. Certainly you are Yotzei if you daven in English. The question becomes, is it better for me to daven in English because I understand what I'm saying? Or is it better for me? You know, there's your Yotzei either way. Right? So it's not a question of what is good and what is bad. But it's a question of which is the better way. And are there different views? Some people say Lashon HaKodesh is so special that one should endeavor. But it may very well be that, you could gradually incorporate more Hebrew. In other words, you do primarily English, and then every week you add a bracha in Hebrew. It might be a way to do that. Because, you are right that the struggle of just trying to read the words correctly can detract from one's kavana overall. Well, yes. The halacha is you have to understand the first breath. That's great. You have to understand the first bracha. Rav Chaim says you have to have the sense that you're talking to God in all the brachas. He's mechalek. He differentiates between kavana in terms of knowing what you're saying and kavana in terms of knowing you're talking to God. The requirement that you know what you say only applies to the first bracha. But the requirement that you have to know you're standing before God applies to every bracha.
When listening to the Megillah, is it preferable to concentrate on the word that you don't understand most of it?
No, because you have a big problem. See, this is a very funny thing. I've never seen this before. Although you could be Yotzei Megillah in every language, this is the paradox, but it has to be written like a Megillah. Meaning to say, you're not Yotzei Megillah reading it from this English. If you'd have a scroll written by a scribe that would be in English, you could be Yotzei. So, therefore, as a practical matter, it's impossible to be Yotzei Megillah in other languages because nobody writes Megillahs in other languages. Therefore, you must hear the Hebrew.
When the Hebrew is read, you should really concentrate on the words.
Well, it's tricky. You know, if you can listen to the Hebrew and not miss a word and see the English at the same time, that's very good. But you shouldn't get lost in the English and then you're not following the Hebrew.
Yeah. There's a different, I think the question, does it involve like different levels of hearing? And technically, in a biological sense, you know, if it's going in,
right,
you can't.
But you have to be aware of the words as they're being said.
Right.
You have to hear the words of the. That's why, you know, there is a mitzuda.
So if you're distracted, though, for one sentence of the whole Megillah, then technically.
Well, you have problems. Technically, you know, you're not supposed to be distracted. You're really supposed to try to hear every word. Every word is a Megillah. You know, the mitzuda is very good for that. You know, the mitzuda is the one that has the linear. They have a few words of Hebrew, then they have English. So they have a mitzuda sitter, which I think Art School probably has overshadowed in popularity. But the Mitzuda also did the five Megillahs, all the five Megillahs. So they actually have a linear answer. I haven't seen it lately, but...
Emphasis put on understanding and comprehension that there isn't any?
Well, let's put it this way. Every mitzvah of the Torah, and every mitzvah of the rabbis, and every holiday is infinitely greater when you comprehend.
That's what we're doing now.
Right. So what you do is you try to prepare ahead of time to go ahead. However, once it's time to actually do the mitzvah, you also got to be careful that you're doing the mitzvah right. And you can't just say, you know, gee, I'd rather sit in my room and study the Megillah. I could get more out of it.
Than, less than yeah. Specifically, in this case, with the Megillah, I shouldn't worry too much about my comprehension during the meeting.
I'm sorry, so repeat it again?
I can't comprehend any of what's being said.
Oh, which part should you focus on?
Well, you already said you should focus on each Hebrew word as it's
right,
said.
Right.
Is it okay if the comprehension that during the time when I'm hearing it goes out the window?
Well, if it's unavoidable, it's unavoidable. You know, in other words, if you can't do everything, you got to pick what you're going to do, and it's more important that you actually hear the words of the Megillah.
Each word
of the Megillah. That's right.
Yeah. Good. First of all, it goes very fast.
Relatively, that's right.
So, I mean, the best thing to do is to, if you can do it, just go and watch, hear the words, in a truly verbal sense.
The truth is, even for anybody, even people who are very familiar with Hebrew, when something is being read very, very quickly, the mind does not fully absorb the language, you know. If Hebrew is not your first language, not my first language, you know, there still is a mental translation. You know, they always say, what language do you dream in? That's really the sign of what is your language, you know. So, if the mind is still translating it into English, so there's going to be a time gap. You're not going to be able to follow the words with Mamish simultaneous translation. That's why the United Nations translators are so amazing. Also the Lubavitcher Rebbe translators are also very good. They kind of have these simultaneous things. As Rebbe's talking, they can, you know, translate in different languages. That's a very... very impressive thing. Okay. Alright, so that's the Aseres B'nei Haman, and you'll notice that it mentions Ubabiza Lo Shalchu Es Yadam. The Jewish people did not take any of the spoils, meaning even though Achashverosh authorized it, the Jewish people did not take any of the spoils. And there are many reasons that were given. One reason is that some of the enemies were Amalekites, and the Jews did not want to take the property of Amalek. Another reason is people should realize that the Jews were doing it for self-defense, and they were not doing it just to plunder or get money. In other words, if they would have vandalized and plundered the property of their enemies, people would just say, they would look at it like, you know, the LA riots or the Watts riots or something of that nature. They would not realize that this was an ultimate self-defense gesture. Now, here, I just want to explain something a little bit. But that is, the next few psukim are halachically very, very important. In fact, Perek Tes is the most important chapter of the Megillah in terms of the halachic dimension of the holiday. As all of you know, Yerushalayim celebrates Purim not on the 14th of Adar. Yerushalayim celebrates Purim on the 15th of Adar. Now, we still have the fast of Esther on the 13th, and then there's this one day that's in between. And let me just explain that a little bit. We know that 14th of Adar is called Purim, the 15th of Adar is called Shushan Purim, and the origin of these two holidays is in this chapter. Basically, what happened was the Jews were given the license to fight against their enemies on the 13th of Adar. They successfully vanquished their enemies on the 13th. They rested on the 14th. They made it a holiday of the, they didn't make a holiday of the day of the war. They made a holiday of the day after the war. That's the 14th. But with Shushan, only Shushan, Esther specifically requested that the Jews be given another day to deal with their enemies who tried to destroy them. And therefore Achashverosh gave Esther an extra day, which was the 14th, to fight. And therefore the resting in Shushan took place on the 15th. Now, so far therefore, if you would read the Megillah, the only thing that should make sense is Purim everywhere is the 14th, and in Shushan only it would have been the 15th, right? Because Shushan got that extra day. No other city got an extra day. But then the Megillah goes on with what seems to be a non sequitur and says, therefore, all cities that are open and without a wall celebrates Purim on the 14th. And the implication, although it doesn't say it, is walled cities celebrate Purim on the 15th. So the halacha is, as it developed, that Shushan Purim is not only observed in the city of Shushan, but Shushan Purim is observed in any city that has a wall. And then the Gemara goes on and says, it doesn't even mean it has a wall today, but it had a wall from the time of Yehoshua bin Nun. So Shushan, we'll try to explain what this has to do with anything. Because remember, the origin of Shushan Purim was connected with Shushan, nothing to do with walled cities. But for reasons we'll talk about in a moment, the concept of Shushan Purim is the observance of Purim in any city that has had a wall from the days of Yehoshua bin Nun, even though it does not have a wall today. Now, Yerushalayim is considered to be a city that was walled from Yehoshua bin Nun. Now, even though you might say, well, at most that would only be the old city, actually not really the old city, but Mount Zion, etc., in other words, the original part of the wall, when it was a Yavusi city, right? But on that, the Gemara has supplementary principles that says any neighborhoods or suburbs of walled cities are considered to be included. And although there are some questions about Neve Yaakov and Har Nof, etc., but there's how far is a suburb, etc. But
it can be seen.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So the Gemara says it has to be seen. But the question becomes, what if it's obscured because of buildings, but it would be seen? Right? So that's where you get into some issues, where you can't see different parts of the city because of buildings, but naturally, by the slope of the land, you would be able to see it. Right? But be it as it may, the consensus of all poskim, or most poskim, although there's some discussion, is that basically every neighborhood in Yerushalayim, even the new neighborhoods that weren't around a few years ago, reads only on the 15th, not on the 14th, because we do know that Yerushalayim has a mesorah that it clearly had a wall from the days of Yehoshua bin Nun. Other cities are questioned. The Gemara says that the city of Tveria, we have a halachic doubt, because although Tveria did have a wall, but one side was totally open to the sea. Not the sea, the Yam Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee. And consequently, the question is, does that have the status of a wall, because it's protected by water? Now, I'm not sure what the minhag is today. The Gemara itself says Tveria is a safek, whether it's a walled city or not, and therefore they have to read Megillah on the 14th and on the 15th. No, I'm not sure what the meaning is.
I think they say it on the 15th, but without a broken.
Okay, so they actually read it twice. Tzfat, some had said, has a wall, although the custom in Tzfat is not to read on the 15th. And some say Haifa had a wall, but again, the custom in Haifa is not. So there are different problems. Some say that Prague, Czechoslovakia, had a non-Jewish community that is as old as Yeshua ben Nun. They had a wall. So some took the position that in Prague he's supposed to read Megillah in the 50. But be it as it may, the question is, what on earth does the concept of a walled city have to do with Shushan Purim? Shushan Purim is described here as Esther asking Ahasuerus for an extra day to defeat the extra enemies in Shushan. So Shushan would have an extra day, and therefore Purim would be a day later. Why would that translate into other walled cities, Shushan? And moreover, why should it be based on Yeshua ben Nun? Shushan had a wall, but Shushan itself didn't have a wall from the days of Yeshua ben Nun. Was that walled cities were often cities in which the non-Jewish inhabitants had special strength, special weapons, special resources. And therefore it is understood that Esther's request for an extra day did not only apply to Shushan, it applied to all walled cities. However, then the question you'll ask is, well, wait a second, so that should depend on something that had a wall during the time of Ahasuerus. Why Yeshua ben Nun? There's nothing to do with it. So here the Talmud Yerushalmi says a funny thing. Talmud Yerushalmi says that the rabbis, in making their takana, wanted to give special honor to the land of Israel. Walled cities are more prestigious than non-walled cities. But in Ahasuerus' time, there were no cities in Israel that had a wall. So if you were to simply say any walled city in Ahasuerus' reign made Purim an extra day later, you would be denigrating the special status of the land of Israel. And therefore the rabbis picked a definition of a walled city that would elevate the cities, many cities in Israel, to that higher standard. Now, putting all this together, I have to admit, it's not a tremendously logical picture, because what you have is the following. The reason why the walled cities that year needed an extra day was because those cities that were walled, the enemies had more resources, more power, etc. So that particular year, the definition of which cities fought an extra day would have been defined by cities that had a wall then, not a wall hundreds of years before. And yet, once the Chachamim make that the differentiation, they want to choose something that will give special kavod to Eretz Yisrael. And therefore we come up with the very unusual halacha that the din of Shushan Purim is for any city that had a wall from the days of Yeshua ben Nun, even though it does not have a wall now, which will elevate many cities in Israel, particularly Yerushalayim, to the status of a walled city, which is a more prestigious type of thing.
When you say from the time of Yeshua ben Nun, does it have to be till a certain point?
No, even if the wall was destroyed.
Before the Purim story.
Oh yes, that's right. Even if there was no wall by the time Purim came along. That's right. Even if there was no wall, Yerushalayim did not have a wall by the time of the Purim story. So that's the origin of Shushan Purim. Now let me just mention a little bit of practical halacha for those of you that want to do this. You know, so living in Yerushalayim, you're in a very, very fortunate way, because you can get to celebrate Purim 2 days in a row. Because in Tel Aviv and B'nai Brak, they celebrate Purim on the 14th of Adar, and Yerushalayim they celebrate Purim on the 15th. So you're able to go. A lot of people do this. A lot of people go to Tel Aviv or B'nai Brak on the 14th. That'll be Monday? Is that Monday or Tuesday?
It's Monday night or Tuesday.
And then they come back to Yerushalayim. So I just want to mention very, very quickly, in case you plan to do this, there are certain complications about where you have to hear the Megillah and when you have to hear the Megillah. The basic standard is this. We have two readings of the Megillah. We have a Megillah reading at night and a Megillah reading in the day. Okay? But the halacha of what defines your obligation is where you are in the morning of that particular day. So therefore, anybody that is planning on being in Tel Aviv, let's say, by dawn, the beginning of the day, by dawn, Tuesday, is mechuyev to hear the Megillah Monday night and Tuesday, even if they're in Yerushalayim. In other words, if you're going to be in Tel Aviv, and again, the point that we measure this by is Amud HaShachar, if you're going to be in Tel Aviv the dawn of the 14th, then you are defined halachically as a resident, temporary resident of an open city, and therefore you must hear Megillah the night before as well as the morning. And similarly, that also means if you're going to be in Yerushalayim the morning of the 15th, you must hear the Megillah the night before. Now let me explain how this would be a problem. Let's assume I go to Tel Aviv the 14th of Adar. Okay?
Is it the 2nd?
I don't have the dates here. It's Tuesday. One second. Tuesday is the 14th of Adar, right? And Wednesday is the 15th of Adar. Okay? So if you're going to be in Tel Aviv Tuesday, but you plan to come back to Yerushalayim very late Tuesday night.
You should tell me you need to
be outside of Yerushalayim. Right. Using that. If you're going to come back to Yerushalayim very late at night, Tuesday, very late at night, after all the Megillah has been read Tuesday night, you're going to have to find the Megillah reader. Because if you're going to be in Yerushalayim Wednesday morning, if you are going to be in Yerushalayim Wednesday morning, you are chayav to hear the Megillah reading Tuesday night, even if your plan was not to be in Yerushalayim Tuesday night. You see? Everything is defined by what you're going to be in the morning. Okay?
So if Tuesday morning, if you wake up, or if you're not in Yerushalayim on Tuesday morning,
yeah,
then Tuesday night you
have to be in the morning.
No. The morning is attached to the previous night.
That's right. If you're, okay, I'm going to go over this again. If you will be in Yerushalayim Tuesday morning, then you must make it, I'm sorry, I'm getting mixed up myself, one second. See, let me explain this. Yerushalayim's Purim is Wednesday. So, in terms of when you get caught up in Yerushalayim's Chiyuv, we have to look at where you are Wednesday. In terms of Tel Aviv's Chiyuv, we look where you are Tuesday. So,
you're going to be in Yerushalayim Wednesday at all?
Okay, if you're going to be in Yerushalayim Wednesday morning at the beginning of the day, you must make it your business to hear the Megillah reading Tuesday night.
In Yerushalayim?
It should be in Yerushalayim.
Right. So after what time?
Huh?
Does the buses leave
Yerushalayim? Well, you're mechuyev to go back to Yerushalayim and hear Megillah. In other words, let me give you an example. The 14th of Adar is what day again? Monday? Tuesday. Okay.
Tuesday.
So
it starts Monday night.
Okay. So let's say you spend Monday night and Tuesday in Tel Aviv. Right. So far so good. Monday night you hear the Megillah in Tel Aviv. Tuesday morning you hear the Megillah in Tel Aviv. But if you were planning on getting back to Yerushalayim before Wednesday morning, three o'clock in the morning.
It goes where you sleep.
Well, it goes where you're where going you to be at the dawn, at the beginning of the morning.
So it's like I'm 5 minutes before sunrise until the rest of the day.
Wherever you are when the dawn breaks will define your chiyuv, even retrospectively for the night before. Okay, that's the thing. If you will be in Yerushalayim
five minutes
before dawn, Wednesday morning, then you better arrange to hear the Megillah in Yerushalayim Tuesday night, even though you weren't planning on coming back.
So if you arrive here at 8 o'clock in the morning...
So you're safe. Mm-hmm. So that's safe. So in truth, there's nothing wrong for a person to say, I'll come back to Yerushalayim Tuesday afternoon or Tuesday late morning. Wednesday. I'll come back to Yerushalayim Wednesday. And then I'm not mechuyev to hear Megillah in Yerushalayim. Because if I was not in Yerushalayim Wednesday Amud HaShachar, I am not a mechuyav in the reading of Yerushalayim.
So you could arrive in Tel Aviv Tuesday afternoon, not be bound to hear the Megillah there, and then come back.
Don't
you have a chiyuv yourself to hear Megillah?
Wednesday afternoon.
That's discussed. They raise that issue. In other words, could it be that a person is not chayav to hear any Megillah? But they say you're mechuyav to put yourself in a situation where you have to hear something. But you have a choice. Now, what's interesting is, this halacha is very, very different. If we just compare this, let's say, to the problem of observing 2 days of Yom Tov, there are all sorts of questions, but if you're, let's say you're an American, and you're here for a year, and you're planning on going back. So the basic halacha is that if you're planning on going back to America, you're mechuyev to observe 2 days of Yom Tov here, even though you're here during Yom Tov. Right? You have to follow the custom of where you came from, the custom of where your home is. Similarly, an Israeli that's in America, to some degree, although he's not allowed to do melacha, but an Israeli in America on the second day of Yom Tov would daven a weekday, or Chol HaMoed davening. So with the laws of Yom Tov, we look at where your permanent place of residence is. But for the laws of Purim, it's a very unusual halakha. We don't look at where you live, or where you come from, or where you plan to go. We simply look at where you are the dawn of either Tuesday or Wednesday. Okay, so it's not defined by where you come from. Even if you're a native Yerushalmi who always lives here, if you are in Tel Aviv Wednesday, you're not mechayiv to hear Megillah Tuesday night. Okay, so it's a very, very different halacha than is the laws of 2 days.
Visiting outside Yerushalayim is first in
Yerushalayim. Well, everything is the same. All of the mitzvahs follow your chiyuv in reading the Megillah.
If you go to Tikvah Tuesday, yeah. So you wouldn't have any. I would say not.
If you're not defined as a resident of Bnei Brak for Purim, you would not be becoming any mitzvah there. So that's just something to be aware of. So the kitzer, as a practical matter, let me just go over the most common scenario. If you decide to go to Bnei Brak Tuesday afternoon, you have no Megillah problems in Bnei Brak. You don't have to hear Megillah in Bnei Brak at all, but you do have to try to get back to Yerushalayim to hear the Megillah Wednesday night.
Tuesday night.
And that would be a problem if you want to get back too late. Right? If you want to get back 2 o'clock in the morning, hearing the Megillah Wednesday morning would not be enough, because if you're going to be in Yerushalayim by Wednesday morning, you're mechuyev to hear the Megillah Tuesday night in Yerushalayim. So you have to claim it. Now I assume there are plenty of late, I can't assume, but in a place, a city like Yerushalayim, there'll be plenty of places you can hear these late Megillah readings. Or you can read it yourself, if you know how to do a candle Megillah. And although you're supposed to read it with the trap, but if you don't know the trap, you could be Yotze reading it from the scroll. Anyway.
The problem with that is there could be many going on at 3 o'clock in the morning, but if you don't find them, you won't find them. You can be a block away and not know it.
That's correct. So,
no way to know.
Yeah, I don't know how you'd know. I mean, I guess people live for it.
It's like
the
Megillah network.
In America, it's got a
I would always imagine, as they say, Zichron Moshe, the Shkibos, would probably have anything. You know, as they say. Okay. So that's the origin of Shushan Purim. And again, it's very, very strange, because to a large degree, the rationale for a Shushan Purim does not really connect to the definition of Yoshua ben Nun. National Shiva Purim connects with things that have a wall there, to have a wall in times of Achashverosh, but the Gemara says this gave kavod for Eretz Yisrael.
On the Megillah reading and the timing of your drunkenness, per se.
Yes.
I mean, is there a tradition where you should hear the Megillah before you start drinking a lot, and then have your drinking? Or I mean, if you're as drunk as you should be on Purim, yeah. Chances are you're not going to hear much of the Megillah. You're going to be
morning.
On the morning.
Well, actually,
morning.
Actually,
no. Let's say that you end up waiting and you hear Megillah.
Actually, it's very interesting. That's a Yerushalayim problem, because I'll tell you why. Because normally, outside of Yerushalayim, you go straight from the fast of Esther to the reading of the Megillah. The custom is we don't break our fast till after the Megillah reading. Right? You go straight from the fast of Esther. So under those circumstances, you would normally not be drunk by Megillah reading. Yerushalayim is a problem, because Yerushalayim, the fast of Esther, is Monday, and the Megillah reading is not going to be until Tuesday night. So theoretically, although it's not Purim yet, but theoretically a person could have Erev Purim or regular Purim and get shikr. But obviously, I mean, you know, you're not Yotzei davening if you're shikr, and you're not Yotzei Megillah if you're shikr. So obviously, you are advised not to drink until afterwards. And one point here, and that is when the Gemara announces that when the pasuk describes the holiday that they made, it originally says, let's find the pasuk here.
Being hungover is not halakhically sugar, though, right? For the morning one.
You can't pay attention.
If you're conscious and you're able to concentrate, even if you have a headache,
you can do it. Last year I heard every word.
Okay.
With an extreme headache and like.
Oh. Okay, that can be done. That can be done. Just
but
take.
It seems like the common problem would be like the person who goes to B'nai B'rak on Tuesday for the mitzvah, yeah, for the Suda, and he drinks. And then he comes back through Shemayim, right. And then he hears the Megillah at 8 o'clock at night. If he hasn't sobered up yet,
well, that's a very important consideration. Meaning, if you're going to B'nai B'rak for a meal, and you have to come back to Yerushalayim Tuesday night to hear Megillah, so you should come back in a state where you're sober enough to be able to hear the Megillah.
That's good. It's only a problem to go to B'nai B'rak Tuesday night, because otherwise there's no appeal to the.
Well, there's no chiyuv of suda, but a lot of people go anyway. A lot of people go just for the social. Well, there's no mitzvah. there's no mitzvah. Some people like to do a little bit more than mitzvah.
It's amazing how Purim just brings out the fervor.
Well,
the
people are, this is one of the mitzvahs. People are very machmir. In fact, let me just mention a vort. We have the famous. So again, one of the mitzvahs of Purim, is shalach manos, sending gifts of food, matanos le'avyonim, gifts for the poor, and the mitzvah of having a meal on Purim, during the day, and the mitzvah of reading Megillah. Right? These are the four basic mitzvahs. Mikra Megillah, Su'udas Purim, shalach manos, and shalach manos is what? Two articles of food to at least one person. Shalach manos ish le'avyonim. Matanos le'avyonim means avyonim is plural, so you're supposed to give charity to at least two poor people. Now, typically, if you give charity to a tzedaka fund, which will give it to a lot of people, that's considered to be giving it to multiple people. Now, it's very interesting that this concept of shalach manos and matanos le'avyonim derives from the fact that if Haman represents the force of Amalek, and Amalek has power over the Jewish people because of hatred within us. Like Haman said, the people are separated and polarized. So we rectify Amalek by trying to build bridges and togetherness between Jews. That's shalach manos, matanos le'avyonim, to show our love and our concern. And in fact, it is brought down that the custom is when you send shalach manos, you're supposed to get a third party to do it, like a shaliach. In other words, I shouldn't give you shalach manos directly, I should ask my friend to give it to you. Why is that? So the Mefarshim say that if the whole purpose of shalach manos is to increase friendship, the more people you get involved in the process, the better. Let's get extra people involved.
Rabbi Sanit's organizing these shalach manos groups where like 10 guys all get together in a pool, and then they all each give each other one. Like,
so they make a little bit of a togetherness. Yeah, I mean, there is a problem. I mean, the Rambam writes that there's a bigger mitzvah to give more charity to the poor than just to give a million shalach manos. You know, sometimes it really goes overboard. I mean, people have, probably in Israel, it's probably a little more moderate, but in the United States, you know, you might be giving to hundreds of people. You know, after a while, it gets a little, little difficult. And particularly, it's only a month before Pesach, so, you know, people aren't so excited to have, you know, tons and tons of chametz. So, because your dilemma is you're either stuck with chametz or you're stuck with a gazillion calories, which isn't so good either, to eat it before Pesach. So there are different issues. And there have been many years I've actually given a lot of shalach manos to homeless shelters afterwards. Because even though, you know, they're non-Jewish, but at least it's a way of helping people. But the thing is, homeless shelters typically do not accept open things. You know, they have to be in packets. You know, there are difficulties there. But
why would it have to be open?
No, but depends on the shalach manos I got. If somebody sent me a home-baked cake or something.
Oh, right.
So, yeah.
A lot of them you see is candy bar.
No, if they're wrapped, that's fine. But some of the stuff you get sent are open things. But that's the idea of what? That's the idea of creating friendship and bridges. Because Amalek has power over us when there's disunity and hatred and polarization. And therefore, when Hashem saved us from Amalek, we have to eradicate the Amalek within us. Now, the idea of the meal of Purim, all of us know, as we just said, a person is obligated to drink on Purim till they don't know the difference between Arur Haman, cursed be Haman, and blessed be Mordechai. And there are a lot of different interpretations of this. Some say, look at the numerical equivalent. Arur Haman, cursed is Haman, blessed be Mordechai, is the same gematria.
Right.
So when you get so drunk you can't figure that out, that shows you you've reached the level. But I think I may have told you some of this, but let me just go over it very quickly. Well, one pshat is like this. One explanation that's given is the following. We are generally grateful for the redemption that Mordechai brought us. Like we had a death sentence on our necks, and Mordechai and Esther were God's messengers to give us that liberation. But we are not grateful for what Haman tried to do to us. And yet, the Gemara says, Haman getting the ring from Achashverosh brought more Jews to Tshuva than 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses. Because all of the prophets tried to bring us to repentance and we never listened. But with Haman we got the Tshuva. So, we're not grateful to Haman per se, but the concept is we have to realize that part of what happened in Purim is not merely our lives were saved, but as a result of the threat to our existence, we turn to Hashem with tshuva and rededication. And you know what the Gemara says? The Gemara says that originally at Mount Sinai, we accepted the Torah out of fear. God held a mountain over our head. And God said, if you accept the Torah, that's great. If not, I'm dropping the mountain. Purim, we accepted the Torah out of love and gratitude. So Purim is a time of Kabbalas HaTorah, not out of fear, but Kabbalas HaTorah out of love. And therefore, in a way, what the Gemara means is the following. A person should be so grateful to God that he's grateful to God not only for what Mordechai did in saving us, but he's grateful to God even for what Haman did, because Haman brought us the tshuva. And, you know, there's a saying from the Ari that Yom Kippur is called in the Torah Yom Kippurim, which literally means a day like Purim. That suggests Purim is even greater than Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is a day like Purim. Now, if you had to pick the most dissimilar days in the Jewish calendar, one might have thought Yom Kippur and Purim are very, very different days. And yet, Purim is also tshuva. Yom Kippur is tshuva out of fear, because God is judging us. Purim is tshuva out of love and gratitude. And therefore, since love is greater than fear, Yom Kippur is a day like Purim, but Purim is also a siman of tshuva. So the drinking on Purim is not to get drunk, per se. The drinking on Purim is to reach a level of joy and serenity, where even the negativity in life, even the gezeira of Haman, I see as part of God's plan to bring us to Him in tshuva and repentance. And one other thing about Purim.
We should drink to reach the level of joy.
Of joy in which we're grateful not only for the Baruch Mordechai, but even for the Arur, even for the Arur Haman. Another thing is that, you know, we say by a poor person, normally, when a poor person asks you for tzedakah, the halacha is that you're allowed to investigate it. In other words, do you need it, etc. But it says on Purim, kol ha-poshet yada, anybody who sticks out his hand, put it in. Yerushalayim people are always sticking out their hand. But on Purim, you have to put something in, no matter what. So the Sifrei Chassidus say, this is the same way it is for davening. When we come to God as supplicants and we daven, God sometimes investigates. Are we worthy? Are we deserving? Do we need what we're asking for? But on Purim, whatever we ask for, God gives us. So it's brought down among Sifrei Chassidus that Purim is a very auspicious time to turn to Hashem in prayer. And therefore,
if people wasted with reveling, we should all be in the shul.
Well, the reveling is part of the mitzvah too. But what has been suggested is, I'm sure here a lot of people do it, people get up early on Purim morning, 5:30 or something. They learn, they daven for 3 or 4 hours, and then by 9:30, they're ready to revel for the day. The simcha is very important too. The simcha is a mitzvah too, but they do reserve a significant chunk of the day for Torah and for learning, because it's called a poshet yad. You stretch out your hand to Hashem, and Hashem gives you. Right? So we often forget that Purim is such a special day for tefillah. So Mir Hashem, we should be zochet to take advantage of that that occasion. Okay. Yeah, I'll see you Sunday. Have a good Shabbos.
Question on the Mishloach Manos. You're still okay. I mean, you're satisfied the mitzvah that you give it by the person, right? You don't have to.
Oh yes. You are yotzer. Yeah. Certainly you're yotzer.
Sometimes it's hard to get a messenger. All these things.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the amount when you give the charity to just two people, my understanding is it has to be enough for that person to get a meal for himself. Is that in terms of the amount you're supposed to get?
But a meal doesn't mean a whole meal. A meal could mean a roll.
But I mean, it probably, people shouldn't be walking around going, here's a shekel, I'm sad. I mean, it should be something substantial.
Something they can buy some food with, yeah.
More than you.
A roll,
stuff that you're supposed to get.
It's an egg of
two
bread.
Two poor people, what's the minimum, right. What's the amount?
To an egg of bread.
What are the poor people supposed to do?
There's a Gemara about a return giving back.
Yeah, the Gemara suggests that poor people were able to exchange their poorer meals. So if you and I were poor, I would give you my bread, and you would give me your bread. Uh-huh. And that way we fulfill Shalach Manos. That's Shalach Manos, but the same thing would be true for gifts for the poor as well. In fact, ideally, there's all sorts of halakhas. When you give people Shalach Manos, you have to give them food that's ready to eat, which is interesting. You cannot give them uncooked food. You can't give them a chicken, a raw chicken. It has to be a cooked chicken. Things like that.
Which would be done in Eretz Yisrael.
It has to be something that is.
It's got to be meal food too. It can't be like candy. I see a lot of they go alongside. They put just enough of actual meal food, and they put the rest candy.
It's better to have a meal food. Bread and wine. Bread and wine are the two best things to get.
Right.
Some of you make
sweets would come.
Usually people eat matanos like animals.
Shalach Manos.
Customary.
You're yotzei, but
it's customary to show it alongside.
Isn't Shalach Manos just two different brachas?
Yeah, but l'chatchila Shalach Manos should be something they make their suda.
See, the funny thing is, everyone has got their bread already. They want the cookies and the cakes and the drinks.
That's what I'm saying. You put a little roll in a thing that's wine or whatever,
and that covers all bases.
And then you put whatever the candy stuff you wanted to give.
The Russian tradition, right. Was sending these colored candy cookies, in different shapes, like a violin and things like that. You would send to your friends.
You think about Shalach Manos,
tradition? I read, Bela Chagall wrote that book, Light, the Light of Simcha's Light or something along that light. Along that line, the book. It was illustrated by Marc Chagall. And she wrote her memory, childhood in Russia. And that was one of the customs.
What was the reason?
Was that part of at Purim, they would send friends, they were little children at that time. So maybe it wasn't actually the mitzvah, but it was at least children would send to each other
cookie cutouts.
Basically, like a little violin decorated.
I remember one of the most moving things. I once read a note that a young woman, she's still alive, now she's an old woman, wrote in a concentration camp. She wanted to send Shalach Manos to her friends. They were both in Auschwitz. And she had no food. So she wrote a home for Shalach Manos. And that was just very concept of, I want to give you something, I have nothing to give you, just myself. This is also the best. Okay, we'll see you. Have a good chance.